Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rafi Mirzayan, one of the co-founders and co-directors of Shoulder 360. Tonight's Coin Flips and Controversies is brought to you by the Shoulder 360 meeting, which is going to be held this year, May 2nd through the 4th, 2024, in Miami, South Beach. We invite all of you to join us. We have three incredible panelists with us tonight who are also speakers at the meeting. Gus, if you can introduce yourself.
Sure, Gus Mazzocca. I'm the medical director of Mass General Brigham Sports Medicine and the chief of sports medicine at Mass General Hospital.
Yeah, hey, Rafi, thanks for having me. Steve Brockmeyer. I'm a professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Virginia and team physician for UVA Athletics.
I'm Sharif Bishai. I'm in Detroit, Michigan at the Detroit Orthopedic Institute, and I'm an assistant professor at Oakland University, William Beaumont Hospital, and Michigan State University.
All right, awesome. Welcome, guys. We're going to talk about a case of a gentleman with a rotator cuff tear. He's 71 years old. He has left shoulder pain. He's retired, but very active. It's his non-dominant shoulder that's hurting him. He's had pain for over 3 months. He has pain with forward elevation, but he does have full range of motion. And at times it can be 10 out of 10 pain. He has difficulty sleeping at night. He is an avid pickleball player and has not been able to play because of his shoulder. He's taking medication. He's tried non-operative treatment. He's had a cortisone injection without significant lasting relief. The last injection was almost 3 months ago. So on examination, let's see. He's just significant for type 2 diabetes and hypertensive. He has full active elevation, but it's painful. He has a positive but minimal atrophy of the supraspinatus and infraspinatus muscles. He has 5-/5 strength in Jobes and empty can testing, but 5/5 strength with external rotation. His active external rotation with the arm at the side is to 60 degrees. He has a negative liftoff in Napoleon signs. He has a negative hornblowers and negative Popeye. His neurovascular exam is normal and his non-tender palpation over the AC joint.
Yeah, I always want to know, was there an injury that happened 3 months ago or was it just insidious onset? I think the 10 out of 10 pain always combined with the type 2 diabetes kind of alerts me a little bit to possible secondary kind of adhesive capsulitis, although he's got full active elevation. I'd really want to look at his passive external rotation and how much pain he had at the end range of motion, just kind of to set the stage and set some expectations. Those would be the big things that I would look at.
Yeah, that's a good point. And he did not have injury. It was an insidious onset. And he did have full passive motion. And the 10 out of 10 pain was just with certain movements. It wasn't constant pain.
No, I mean, I think that Gus makes some good points. I think that gives a pretty clear history. And you know, I think all of us here, despite the title up in the upper left-hand corner, so we know what we're going to find here, I think all of us are thinking likely some level of rotator cuff disease here.
Yeah. All right. So looking at his AP x-ray, Sharif, do you see anything on the AP x-ray?
A couple of things. I mean, first of all, he's got a very low sloping lateral acromion, and you can almost see some sclerosis there as though he's been articulating on that. So when I see that sclerosis on that undersurface of the acromion, immediately my first thought, even without any superior migration, I'm thinking there might be a cuff tear.
Great. Yeah. And Brock, what do you see as far as the joint being centered? Is there superior migration at this point?
No, it's a great x-ray, a nice gracie view, so you can see the joint nicely. Really not even subtle signs of arthrosis in the joint that I'm seeing at least. And then if you look at on the AP, you know, if you look at the tuberosity, not a lot of tuberosity reaction. So I agree with Sharif. You know, you can see some sclerosis of the underside of the acromion, but not as much on the tuberosity, which is reassuring. And yeah, the axillary to me looks pretty good as well. You know, don't really see anything that is a huge red flag here, at least from my perception.
So we're going to move on to the coronal oblique MRI. Gus, tell us what you see on the coronal obliques.
Looks like a large supraspinatus rotator cuff tear retracted to the humeral head or glenoid, however bad you want to make it sound. There's some high signal surrounding it, so some reaction in that area. Looks like he's got a little bit of tendon left on the greater tuberosity at one of those or two of those cuts. That always kind of alerts me and makes me a little nervous because we know we're going to have to shorten if we have to try to repair it. I usually look at the sagittal oblique next.
Yeah.
Just to find out. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
The key points, I think, is that there's enough of a stump left, the tendon stump left, and it's not retracted past the glenoid. So it's slightly medial to the dome of the humeral head. I think those are the two points that you said. Yeah. So on the sagittal obliques.
So some enlargement of the teres minor. Actually, infra looks pretty good, even though there does look to be extension of the tear beyond the supra into the infra. And you could kind of catch that on the coronals, but the sagittal obliques certainly kind of show that. But overall, the muscle's pretty well maintained here. So I would, at worst, call the supraspinatus a Cataly A1 and maybe 1 versus 2 in the infra, but overall, well, you know, the muscle bulk is well preserved, maybe with just some medialization due to the retraction of the supraspinatus.
Rafi, yeah. try to stop the video and then show what Steve's talking about, where some of that infra is involved. Show people that may not read these a lot where you're looking for that, so people can kind of see.
Okay, so this is the scapular spine right here. This is the base of the coracoid. This right here is the supraspinatus. So if you draw a line for the tangent sign, the muscle belly is above the tangent line. So as Steve was saying, there's a lot of muscle bulk there. And this is the infraspinatus. There's some fluid around it, but the muscle bulk itself is excellent. I know this is not a T1 sagittal oblique, so it's not great to look at fatty infiltration, but you can see plenty of muscle bulk, and the teres minor is here as well. All right. And then for the axials, Sharif, why don't you tell us what you see here on the axials?
So obviously you see the supra is out, but the subscap, you see a little superior leaf tear and quite a bit of fluid behind it. It looks like biceps is trying to escape from the groove. So there's a subscap that's also related with this too.
Yeah. So upper border subscap right here, and you can't see a really nice biceps and not a black round circle. And as it goes further down, you can see there's like hypertrophy and splitting of the biceps in this one view right here. So this looks like a very high grade partial thickness tear of the long head of the biceps and upper border subscap tears. Okay, great. At this point, Gus, what's your thought process? You've heard the history physical. He's already failed non-operative treatment. We've seen the imaging studies. He's going to need surgery, or you're deciding to do the surgery.
I think by looking at the muscle quality there, I'm thinking more of a repair with a backup of biceps if I need some more tissue. I would talk to him about that. That's kind of what I'm thinking, just based on that MRI 3 months. I'd probably like it better if he had some type of injury. That's kind of what I'm thinking right now.
So I like Gus's idea of using the biceps. However, we know that within the groove, it doesn't look so great. So this might be one where you go down into the groove, you tenodesis it, or even if it's that bad, do a subpec tenodesis, but maintain that proximal biceps for an augment with the repair. My worry is because of that remnant that's left laterally, you know that you're going to have to medialize your repair. So in my hands, I would do a repair with some type of augmentation, including the biceps and a tenodesis.
So first of all, I got to make the comment, this guy's 71, but his muscle bulk is impressive. This guy's jacked. I'm assuming he's a pretty active guy, you know, the pickleball, et cetera. So this is a guy that I would choose an operation to try to restore function. And so for me, it's a number 3 plus or minus, as both Gus and Sharif point out, having options available if you're worried about either tissue loss, which he looks to have on the MRI, or tissue quality. I don't think I would go in there planning to use the biceps because his biceps looks pretty trashed. So for me, this is a guy who gets an upper border subscap, a subpec biceps tenodesis, and then an arthroscopic cuff repair with at least having the option, if not planning, to use a dermal autograft, or excuse me, a dermal allograft as an augment if necessary.
Great. Okay. I think those are great answers. Let's see what the global community said, voted on. So this is people who voted across the world. And the number one answer was a rotator cuff repair alone. So the majority of people would do a rotator cuff alone. Surprisingly, about a fifth of the patients would said they would just debride the cuff or do a decompression. Would any of you just debride the cuff and leave it alone? Is that even an option for you guys?
No, not for me. Not with knowing that he has good muscle bulk and that there's a high likelihood that with medializing it and doing a tension-free repair and doing some of the other things we discussed, that they'd probably have a very good outcome.
Yeah, I agree. What actually was the most shocking answer to me was that about 10% of the respondents said they would do an arthroplasty. Do you think an arthroplasty has a role in this patient where there's tendon stump there, there's good muscle, he's an active person? Would that ever be a consideration for any of you?
That would not be my go-to here. I can understand, the guy's in his 70s, so I think some people worry about cuff healing and people individual. But I don't think that this guy, the way you're describing him, sounds like somebody who's physiologically elderly, and he does not sound low demand. So I certainly, as a first line, a reverse arthroplasty is probably not going to be my go-to.
I agree with Steve, but I can understand what people, based on what Steve had said before, where this is an active guy that wants to return as quick, the rehab after a reverse arthroplasty is going to be faster than this massive rotator cuff repair, plus or minus augmentation, all this other stuff that we may or may not do. So that's probably why those people guess that, I would think. You guys agree with that?
I would say that I agree with that. And I think in many cases, you have these patients that come in asking for the arthroplasty because the person they're playing pickleball with just had it and how fast they recovered and how fast they return. So sometimes when you have these conversations and you tell them the longevity of the recovery of a rotator cuff repair, they're quickly saying, well, my friend just had this and they were back in just a couple months with the replacement. But I would need to see significantly more fatty atrophy and at least some arthritis to really feel like I was doing this patient a service by going to arthroplasty.
Yeah, I agree with everything you guys said. I think, the arthroplasty should be the last resort. It is artificial parts and there's, risk factors and complications associated with that. So anytime I can do a soft tissue repair, especially with good quality muscle and tendon, I'm going to choose that every day and try to talk my patients into that. So, and just because something worked for one of their teammates or colleagues that they're playing doesn't mean it's the right thing for you to have. So that would be my thought process. Okay, let's move on to the next question. All right, so this is a question of, when do you decide to augment rotator cuff repairs? When you're in surgery or before surgery, how do you decide who gets augmentation and who doesn't?
I've had a bad track record with augmentation. I've tried to publish that poor record. I would say that biologic augmentation does a great job of holding on to cells. When you're trying to augment with some type of biologics, they do a terrific job with that. But I have not found that they have helped me a great deal in augmenting rotator cuff repair. So I'm probably not a person that's going to add any type of allograft patch in this case. In my hands, it has not worked so well for me.
Okay. I just want to clarify, we use augmentation as a one big term, but there's two types that of augmentation. One is a mechanical graft that strengthens the repair. And the other, I think of it as a cellular augmentation where we kind of speed up the repair. So you're telling me you haven't had great success with mechanical grafts, but are you using any cellular kind of biological augmentation in your cuff repairs?
Yeah. Right now we use the Bursa. And we found that it has a lot of pluripotential cells in it, and those cells are very active, which was very kind of surprising as we compared it to, concentrated bone marrow, which we thought was a gold standard. So that's not a new idea. It's been around for a long time. And that's kind of our biologic, kind of inexpensive biologic augmentation. So that's what we use.
Okay. Steve, what's your thought process? Do you tend to use more mechanical augmentation to strengthen your repair, or are you trying to do things to speed up the healing?
So I've used both. It's hard because I think, so while Gus says that there's not great evidence out there, I think there's decent evidence. It's just hard to really hone in on the indications and when to use what. At least that's my interpretation of it. I think there are certain circumstances, like a revision case, for example, where, you know, something has led to poor healing or a re-tear. So I think, you know, the justification is certainly there to use both mechanical plus or minus biologic augmentation to try to stimulate, healing where healing failed once. In this case,
just
the guy
wait,
with
just
the,
to, just, yeah, just go ahead, to add, sorry, I said in my hands, that hasn't worked. In other people's hands, it's worked pretty well.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that there's good data out there. It's just really hard to know when it's indicated and or necessary. This guy's got your kind of standard attritional rotator cuff tear, but he's got preserved muscle and he's got decent tendon. And so I think probably the most common operation this guy gets is an arthroscopic cuff repair without any type of augmentation. So I don't know that we have the data to kind of tell us, do we need to augment this either mechanically or biologically? But at this point in time in my practice, I use mechanical augmentation more commonly, meaning an allograft, dermal graft, than I am using some sort of cellular graft. Although Gus's bursal cells to me actually sound like a really nice option from the standpoint of using, available cells. So from a cost conscious standpoint, something that certainly may have some promise.
So I think in this particular patient, he's an at-risk patient. He's older, he's diabetic, he's got a cuff that left a little remnant. So you know you're 0 for 3 on those right away. So for me, those who know me, I'm an early adopter of many, things like this. And so in my hands, I use a mechanical and biologic augmentation, which gives me the best of both worlds. It will wick what's around it. So the bursa, you can even squirt some of that in there. So you're going to be able to get a lot of different things working in your favor, both biologically and mechanically with this repair.
Okay. Let's see what the global community said. They would augment with the biologic alone. So that's the cellular augmentation. About a third of the patient or respondents said that. 22%, they would augment with the mechanical graft alone. And then 14%, they would do augment with mechanical and biologic. All right. So if you're going to do mechanical, we kind of touched on this as far as options. Sharif, why don't you tell us what mechanical graft you're using? I know you've worked with several different patches and stuff that's available on the market. What are you using currently? Why do you like using it?
Yeah, I have a little algorithm in my brain where if it's a partial thickness, I use one that was designed with just type 1 collagen. I have one in my own shoulder that's done very well. When I need something here, I want something that's mechanical as well as biologic, and that's going to be one that's going to be type 1 collagen, which is a xenograft, but also has PLLA in it for strengthening. If the tendon is good, but maybe I'm just worried about the healing, I might use a synthetic that goes under the cuff, which is going to wick some of the biology from doing some marrow ventilation of that. And, so in those particular cases, I'm watching Gus laugh because of all the things he's done, and he's the brains behind all this. But that's what I've found worked in my hands, and in some of the things that I've done studies on, it's worked very well.
How about you, Steve?
Yeah, my main go-to is acellular dermal matrix. I've used that most commonly. I have some experience with some of these other options. I think Sharif is thoughtful about the different indications for both mechanical and biologic utilization in these circumstances. And I think that's, what I was trying to say when we were discussing the last slide. I think the different indications may call for different things. I'm excited that this area continues to grow and there are additional options looking at the enthesis and kind of restoration of that when you have good tissue, but you're just trying to make sure it heals versus something where you have poor tissue and you may need something both structural as well as biologic.
Yeah, I think, dermal allografts has been my graft of choice when I'm doing mechanical augmentation. There's several biomechanical studies that shows that it's advantageous, one of which was done in your lab, Gus. And then there's multiple clinical, you know, prospective randomized trials. And we actually just published a meta-analysis showing that the dermal allograft augmented repairs had a lower re-tear rate. So because of that, that's like my graft of choice.
I kind of in the Larry Field camp with the biceps tendon. It's right there. It's kind of very efficient. It usually can give you some tissue to hold on to if you're kind of struggling. Sometimes in those tears that are kind of retracted posterior medially, and you have a little, you can't get it quite over to, you know, the footprint more anteriorly, it can kind of help you in that case. So I actually like the you know, the autograft long head of the biceps now.
Hey, yeah, Gus, real quick, what happens if you have a proximal rupture and there's no biceps? Is it just the bursa that you'll augment with biologically?
That's another, you know, another, it depends on, like you were talking about, it depends on what type of tendon you have, although we're poor at judging that. You know, Paul Sethi and I did a study on judging rotator cuffs and then looking at it histologically, and we really had no idea, even though we thought we did. So I think as you're in that case trying to repair it and finding out what you need, if you can't get it, I still do a lot of margin convergence as well. So I try my best to go all autograft, whatever tissue I have, augment biologically with that bursa that's right there. You know, if something happens or you don't have it, then I will go with a old school margin convergence.
What if this guy's got a really chewed up biceps, right? There's this patient, you know, you can see on that MRI steps is going to be in really bad shape. Are there limits to what you're going to use, Gus, as far as like, all right, that biceps is really not going to add much?
Yeah, you know, I hold a lot of stock in a subpectoral biceps test where I palpate that biceps underneath the pec. If they don't have any pain there, then I'm not messing with the biceps, no matter what it looks like, which is, you know, kind of crazy sometimes, but that's true. If they have pain there, then what I would do is do the rotator cuff repair, augment it with the biceps is there, and then go down and do a subpectoral tenodesis.
Yeah, but I agree with Gus there, because if regardless of what it looks like up in the joint, it's still collagen that's an autograft. And so as long as you don't leave it connected distally and you do a subpec tenodesis distally, you have a lot of collagen to play with up top.
Great. Let's see what the global community vote was. Yeah, the majority of people said they would use a long head of the biceps tendon autograft, and then allograft was second place with about 20%, and then xenograft and other synthetics are catching up in popularity. Okay, so let's go to the next question is, so if you're going to use the biologic, the cellular, we kind of touched on the bursal stem cells, Gus, you've done a lot of work on that. How easy is it to work with it once you harvest it with a device that you add onto your shaver to kind of collect all it? How do you prepare the bursal tissue and how do you deliver it into the subacromial space?
Yeah, Rafi, that's a great question and a little disappointing. It's still kind of a goofy part of that operation. It's variable. We've gone away. For a long time, we're using, autologous thrombin and PRP combined with the PPP to make kind of a fibrin clot. I always thought that would be fantastic, because that goes away in 6 weeks. You could put it below, you could put it above. There were no worries about it, but that wasn't really as reproducible as we wanted it to be. The application of the, so we prepare the bursa on the back table, just try to mince it up as well as you can, try to get it into a fine paste. But then the application of that underneath the repair, also can become variable and challenging. And we try to work on all different types of ways to implant that everywhere from like pediatric chest tubes to various cartilage delivery systems. And I would still say it's not as reproducible as I would like. All the residents and fellows and staff, nurses, techs, I tell them all, please think of a way to make this better. So we're not really there yet, but I try to put it underneath that double row and then I try to seal it off. And then any left we usually put on top after we do, you know, if you do a subacromial decompression or anything else. And I would say that,
are you doing a study with this, Gus? Like, are you following the re-tear rates? Are you getting post-op imaging on your patients?
We are looking at all those patients and collecting them right now. And, okay. And, we have had some preliminary work, before I landed where I am now, where we did in a comparison to other studies that we had done, saw that the re-tear rate was lower with that. So that's encouraging. But we don't have a randomized prospective trial going on right now, which of course will be the final chapter.
Okay. Steve, do you use any of these, cellular biologics? Do you have any experience with any of these?
I have some experience with bone marrow aspirated concentrate. My interest is piqued by Gus's resident bursal stem cells. No experience with adipose. My understanding of the literature for PRP as an augment for cuff repair is that it's not really been shown to help. So I haven't really gone down that path, but probably about 10 to 15 cases using bone marrow aspirated concentrate in certain circumstances.
How about you, Sharif?
Yeah, BMA I've used a few times. The PRP, actually, there are some studies actually showed on those medium-sized tears it actually slowed healing, so I went away from that. I don't know much about the bursal other than what I've learned from Gus previously and more tonight, and definitely have interest, and maybe we can help him figure out a way to do it better and easier so that we can all use it because he's onto something.
We need it. I want to do shout out to Pietro Randelli, who did do a randomized prospective study with the adipose tissue. And that's actually also, I believe, they're probably very similar cells in both of those areas.
All right. Yeah, I think bone marrow aspirate is probably the only one that has really proven efficacy in lowering re-tear rates. Originally, the Hernigu study, and then Brian Cole and Nick Verma out of Rush did a prospective randomized trial and showed that the bone marrow aspirate actually reduced the re-tear rate. So if I had access to it in my system, in my hospital system, that's what I would use to speed up the healing process. Let's see what the global community voted. Majority of them said they would not choose a biologic augmentation, but PRP was actually the number one choice. Bone marrow aspirate, 11%. And only 1% said they would use adipose-derived tissue. So the next question is the rotator cuff healing index that was described by Kwon from Korea. Do you guys know about that? Do you use it at all in your practice?
But basically, it's a group of factors that we know have impact on healing of rotator cuff repairs, and specific factors related to the patient, including patient age and other variables, as well as then tear variables that include level of retraction and muscle atrophy and things of that nature. I do use it in my practice I wouldn't say in a rigid sense, but very much in a, kind of a commonsensical way where I measure these, I pay attention to these variables and I get an idea of where the patient sits. And if they have a low ROHE score, like in the, 1 to 4 range, then typically it's something I'm pretty comfortable with, just a standard cuff repair. If you get up in the 6 to 7 range, theoretically, maybe this is somebody who's at risk. And so you may want to consider doing more. And so this patient, for example, he's got the diabetes, he's got his age, obviously a very retracted tear. And so he's got enough variables that probably puts him, and I don't know, Rafi, you may have calculated this for him, but I bet he's in the 6-7 range, if not higher, in which case, again, some of the stuff we're talking about here is probably indicated.
Sharif, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, Brock, that was an excellent explanation, because I think that's really what it comes down to, is to figure out who's at risk. And whether you want to be dogmatic about it and say, if it's these numbers, I'm going to do that, great. But I think what this is, the Kwon score, ROHE score, is essentially trying to give us some guidance of the likelihood of healing. And we're starting to see more and more of these. I mean, we're looking at small tears that are healing at, or failing 26% of the time, large 50%, you know, these massives are into the 60s and 70s now. So we're not doing something right. So if there's anything that can give us guidance, such as this particular article and looking at it and doing the score, telling us we need something more than just a repair, then I'm all for it. So I do use it with my my indications.
Yeah, I think it's a great tool that we should all know and use, because whenever I ask questions in the panel is like, how do you judge who gets it? The number one answer the surgeons give is poor tissue quality. I assess tissue quality, and if it's bad, that's when I augment. And as Gus just said, in their study with Paul, they went through 100 patients, did histology, they scored them, they rated them, and looked at post-op imaging. And even experienced surgeons looking at tissue quality could not reliably predict which ones were going to do poorly and which ones were going to do well. So the Rohe score is the best tool we have right now that's going to help us decide what the healing rate is of what we do. So some of the criteria that I want to go over, because we have people listening on a podcast that may not be able to see the screen, but age over 70, which this patient is 71, an AP tear size of greater than 2.5 centimeters, you get 2 points for that. Retraction 1 to 2 centimeters is 1 point, 2 to 3 centimeters is 2 points, and greater than 3 centimeters is 4 points. And then fatty infiltration of the infraspinatus with Gutalia grade 2 or higher, you get 3 points for that. They looked at bone mineral density. If it's less than 2.5 standard deviations, you get 2 points. And then if they're high level or work or sports activity, you get 2 points. So you add up the points, and if you have 0 to 1 point, your healing rate is 99.5%. If you have a score of 2 to 4, your healing rate is 89%. And if you have a score of 5 to 6, your healing rate drops down to 67%. And 7 and higher, you're down to 37%. So there seems to be a massive drop off when you go from a 4 to like a 5 or a 6. So Pat Denard and Ashish Beatty did a study or published on their cutoff was 7. Which to me, that's a 37% healing rate. That's kind of low for me. So my cutoff is a 4. Anything over a 4 gets an augmentation. And the calculation on this patient, it was about a 5 or a 6. So that's why I chose to do augmentation on him based on the Rohe score.
So Rafi, real quick with the Rohe, if your 4 is where they get an augment, where do they not get a repair? Is there a number for you? Like if they're at 7 or 8, are you just going to say, so going back to arthroplasty being a choice, is there a number that when you look and say, wow, they're an 8, yeah, even with an augment, I could put PRP, BMAC, adipose, RBSC, I could put it all in there. Is it still going to fail? Chances are is yes. So at what, yes, what number is an arthroplasty?
That's a very good point, because all we're looking at is over 70 gets 2 points, but let's say the patient was 80 or 85 and their Rohe score was 2 or 3. Or if there was significant atrophy of the supraspinatus and infraspinatus, I'm not going to repair those. Even if I can repair them, the muscle's dead and they're way older. So the risk of failing to me is a lot higher than a 7-year-old with these numbers. So that's when, you know, the age of the patient and the muscle quality of the infra and the supra is going to dictate more if I can repair it, if I'm going to repair it or not. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, that's great.
But I'd also say that the Rohe score was talking about failure, and then you make a jump to adding augmentation to that, like it's gonna make it all better. That's the only thing I want to warn people about. That little jump, Rafi, is maybe, as politely as I can say, in the coin flips. Faulted.
That's a very good point, because we don't have studies that show that if you augment with a higher Rohe score, if you can actually lower the retail rate. That's a very good point, Gus. But as of right now, this is the best tool that I have to kind of guide me on who gets augmented and who doesn't, because we surely can't augment everyone just from a cost standpoint.
I do think the Rohe score is great to counsel patients as well. You know what I mean? And I think that kind of sets some expectations, and then they can make a decision too, a little bit more informed, you know, like you can have a good discussion, because just like Sharif was saying, maybe they do choose a reverse in that case, you know, like yeah, you could make a case that this guy is a Rohe of 8.
So guys, are any of you doing a standard, or are you any of you doing a subacromial decompression routinely in acromioplasty along with the rotator cuff repairs? Gus, do you do that routinely?
Plus and minus. I think that there's a lot of literature out there that shows that it doesn't really help. However, if you have a type 3 acromion, then I definitely do think it would help. So in that case, I'll absolutely do it. I think we kind of make a big deal about this for kind of not a lot of reason. I think that if you're worried, I know my old partner, Bob Arciero, used to talk about doing it anyway, giving more room for the repair. We know we're changing the biomechanics of that shoulder. So why would you not do it? So I think that it's a plus or minus if people feel strongly one way or the other. But you don't hang your hat on it, I guess.
How about you, Steve?
Well, Gus's answer really clarified it for me, I got to say. I think the key point that he made that I would agree with is I don't think there's a significant downside. So if there's a lateral overhang, in this case, if you look at those x-rays, there's a lateral overhang of the acromion. So in this one, I would do kind of a lateral planing or, you know, kind of a lateral acromioplasty. You know, there's this whole concept of the critical angle of the shoulder and all these variables that maybe from the standpoint of the bony alignment of the shoulder that could contribute. So I think you do want to think about these things. I do think that there are some rotator cuff tears, the kind of the ones where there's good bursal and synovial, you know, cells all the way up to the tear where it's not retracted. Those I actually try my best to kind of leave, you know, as undisturbed as possible. I repair it and I leave the, you know, kind of the natural cell layers there to try to augment or try to allow for kind of essentially normal healing there. So I think it's tear by tear. But I would say if you're asking me, do I commonly do it? Very commonly. And I would say at least 80 or 90% of the time, you'll find some level of a prominence either anterior or laterally that you're going to, in my opinion, you'll probably want to address.
How about you, Sharif?
Yeah, I agree with both of my colleagues. I think if you look back at the data, 70 to 90% of cuff tears are patients with a type 2 or type 3 acromion. So that study, I never really understood that it doesn't necessarily make a difference, which I can agree with. However, if you looked at those that had re-tears, they were the ones with the type 2s and type 3s. So why wouldn't I just take a couple minutes, smooth out that acromion? It may not help in the healing of it, but it will help in the possibility of preventing a re-tear, which was not a outcome that they actually necessarily like called out. That's where I was frustrated with that paper.
I used to do it routinely until I was teaching at a ASCS resident course at the OLC, and Gus looked at me and said, "Are you crazy? I never do that anymore." So I haven't done a decompression for a rotator cuff repair ever since that course, Gus. Thanks.
Yeah,
to you.
Well, I was influenced by Dr. Mattson, who you know is obviously one of the greats. So
yeah. So about half the respondents said they would do a subacromial decompression along with the rotator cuff repair. How about a distal clavicle excision? What are your indications to do a Mumford? It seems like just about every MRI that you read of a shoulder, there's some sort of mild, moderate, severe degenerative change in the AC joint. So do you rely on the MRI findings? Is it a clinical find decision? Is there osteophytes? Sharif, let's start with you. What's your indication?
You know, the patient has to tell me they hurt at the AC joint. I mean, there's a lot of arthritic AC joints that don't hurt. And for me, if they hurt, have a cross arm, or if you're looking at the MRI and there's a big overhang and effacement of the supraspinatus, then I might coplane it. But to do a true distal clavicle excision, the patient has to prove to me that they have pain with a cross arm.
Steve, how about you?
I fully agree with Sharif. Pretty uncommon, actually. I would say, you know, less than 10%. And frankly, I think his first statement really summed up. The patient needs to basically direct you to that joint as being a kind of a major source of their symptoms, and pretty uncommon, at least in my practice, where I find that's going to be the case.
How about you, Gus?
No, I agree wholeheartedly. I haven't done one in a long time. Besides them telling me they had pain, I would definitely do an ultrasound injection of that joint and made sure that pain went away after that injection. And that would be the only time that I would consider it.
Yeah,
so you don't know, just you know, yeah. You know how I feel about the AC joint and damaging it.
Yeah, that was my next question, Sharif. If you do a distal, how much do you take? How do you make sure that you're not over resecting? What's your criteria? How much to take?
So I hope no insurance companies aren't listening, but I do usually the width. I usually do the width of the burr, which is about 5 to 6 millimeters. I take it up to, but not through the superior AC ligament, but I dictate that I take a centimeter so that I can get paid for it.
Uh-huh. Okay. So how about you, Steve?
I didn't realize that you had to dictate a certain width. Maybe I'm not getting paid for it. Should you have any nervous? I actually use the same thing. So I use a 4 millimeter burr, and you know, my goal is to make it so that the burr moves kind of cleanly within the space, but no more than that. And I try to come in from the front, and I try my best to preserve both the superior and the posterior capsular tissue to try to make sure that you don't have any issues with you know, post instability. And you want to make sure also that you do a kind of a uniform resection. I think one of the, you know, the kind of pitfalls is that you resect the inferior part and leave a little bit of a ridge superiorly. It's kind of easy to do sometimes if you're not seeing around the corner well.
So yeah, oftentimes, go ahead, Gus. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, after I do it, so I view from my anterior lateral portal and work through my anterior portal. So I'm essentially going straight up. And then what I'll do is every now and then, like when I think I'm done, I'll move my camera into my anterior portal and look up. And oftentimes that's when you see that gothic arch of bone that's still there. And that's how I make sure that I don't have that x-ray in the office that I want to kick myself for.
Two tricks that I was going to say that I do, which probably can extend the case a little bit, is I will take spinal needles and measure and take an x-ray of it. And then to try to get that superior spur that's oftentimes there, that if you're using a burr, that's when you start to damage that superior, anterior, superior ligament. I'll take a small curette, a long curette from the spine surgeons, and I'll use that arthroscopically to kind of peel that off so I can use the smooth part of the curette to lift off a little bit of that superior tissue without damaging it, and then kind of shell out some of that superior spur. Makes me feel better.
And some of our younger surgeons may not realize that a pituitary works really well after you curette that soft tissue off, and just take that pituitary and break off that superior fight.
Is it the spine spine webinar? These guys are really well versed.
No, seriously,
Harrison Rongers and the like.
I was thinking the same, Steve. All right, so about 63% they would not resect it. 10% said they would. And then the 10% said they would do it based on intraoperative findings. And then one other thing, just the tuberosity preparation. Sharif, what do you do for the tuberosity preparation? You kind of alluded to it earlier, but give us a more formal answer.
Yeah, so for me, I will burr it just to get the soft tissue off. I do not decorticate it. These days, especially in Michigan, I have a ton of patients with vitamin D deficiency and poor bones. So the last thing I want to do is have something where I can't get a good bite with my anchor, even though I'm probably going to switch to all soft tissue anchor anyway to get subcortical fixation. However, these I will then, after I get my two medial anchors in between those, I'll take the smallest tap I can find and try to see if I can get some bone marrow elements through there, and then place my lateral anchors so that I get all that juice underneath that rotator cuff.
How about you, Steve?
Yeah, I don't decorticate, but I definitely remove all the soft tissue. I would say more often than not, I do vent the tuberosity. I think the literature is a little bit divided there, but in my mind, I think, you know, we know that the rotator cuff tissue itself is a bit dysvascular. So I think introducing vascularity to the equation makes sense to me. So that's typically my approach.
Yeah, nothing really to add. I think that it's kind of dealer's choice, kind of what you're brought up with. I kind of remove a lot of that soft tissue, like Steve says. I don't vent the bone marrow there. I use a little meniscal rasp to roughen it up, but I'm kind of even more moving away from that, to be honest with you. I don't know if it's really helped. You know, we're still really trying to figure out how to heal that, right? One thing that's important to say is that when we talk about these rotator cuffs healing, they never really heal back to an enthesis. They're healing with some sort of disorganized collagen scar variable. And yeah, that's the best that we talk about.
Do you guys ever use a radio frequency wand, one of the wands to kind of melt the tissue off the bone before you go over it with the burr? Do you think that's you causing osteonecrosis with the heat that's created, or what do you do?
I've never thought it through like that, and I've probably used it for 5,000 cuffs by now, and I haven't seen anything that makes me have any pause. So I usually get the soft tissue off, and then that's when I run the burr on it. But again, I do not decorticate.
Yeah. So I think what Snyder described, the creating the crimson duvet with the bone marrow venting and the microfracture and stuff of the tuberosity, makes sense. But we just published a meta-analysis comparing with and without marrow venting, and it did not reduce the retail rate. So I agree with you, Gus. I don't marrow vent because it's not affecting the healing rates. So, but let's see what the global community said to that. They likely decorticate with the burr. That's what the majority of people said. Only about 16% said they would decorticate with bone marrow venting, and 7% said they would just do bone marrow venting or microfracture.
I want to ask the panel post-op rehab.
Okay, so Gus, you just brought up a great point. What do you guys do for rehab after a large to massive rotator cuff repair?
Yeah, this tear gets fixed. Steve, Sharif, and Rafi.
So bullet points for me, I immobilize in a shoulder immobilizer sling for 6 weeks. I have them do kind of some very gentle pendulums and distal range of motion for the first 2 weeks. I have them start formal physical therapy, but one therapy visit per week for the first 4 weeks. And it's really only passive. And I set parameters based on tissue quality and repair, integrity. You know, if I'm really happy with repair, I can let them do a little bit more versus if it's a little bit more tenuous. But I do want to have, I think motion does instill healing, but I think you want to be cautious not to stress the repair. At 6 weeks, they start to do active assisted and then active. I limit strengthening until about 10 weeks and then return to full activities anywhere from 3 to 4 months, depending on what that activity is and the level of demand.
I'm very similar. I'm 6 weeks in a sling. I still am getting coverage for CPM, so I'll let them start CPMs almost immediately. And at 4 weeks, they'll start therapy and they get passive from 4 to 6 weeks. They go active assist 6 to 8, active at 8. And then at 10 to 12, just like Steve was saying, I'll start strengthening. One thing, however, in this particular patient, just because of the diabetes, I would actually do a rotator interval. I just remove that just to help with forward flexion, external rotation, so they don't get stiff later on down the line.
Yeah, I'm in a sling for 6 weeks. They can come out of the sling, do passive external rotation stretching with the arm at the side. In the first 6 weeks, they start active assist range of motion at 6 weeks, active range of motion at 3 months, no strengthening till 3 months, and then they're full back to everything about 5 to 6 months. So I'm a little bit slower than you guys, I think.
We're very close, though. So very close.
Yeah, same. I 6 weeks sling. The one thing I do, because I do believe in that rodeo paper, even though it was with dogs, I go to 12 weeks before I start strengthening. And I'll also have them wear part of that sling while they're doing their active assisted and active range of motion from 6 weeks to 12 weeks, just as a signal to others that they're still in the healing phase and to remind them a little bit. They don't have to wear it at home. And then at 12 weeks, we start strengthening, and I tell them they'll feel about 80% better and be back to most of everything at 6 months.
Gus, that's a great point about the out of the house at 6 weeks with the sling. I'll take the abduction portion off and say, yeah, use it just when you go outside as a stop sign to others.
Yep. No, I think that's really helpful to people because they're in a situation where somebody falls in front of them and then they either help them or they look like a jerk. So they have the sling on. Now everybody knows they're hurt.
But I get them out of it at 8 weeks. I'm like, regardless, at 8 weeks, you can do what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so this is what I did for this gentleman. I did a rotator cuff repair with a dermal allograft augmentation. So my two medial anchors are placed right off the articular margin. I pass all the sutures through the cuff, bring it outside of the lateral cannula, do all the suture passing outside of the body, introduce it through a cannula. This is a 8-millimeter cannula. I've gone to using larger cannulas to make it easier to pass. So this is a grasper pusher type of device to help just kind of push the graft in. And then on the medial side, I take the sliding tension stitches that helps to kind of anchor the graft in place. And then laterally, just bring the fiber tapes over and just do like you would for your rotator cuff and get compression and incorporation of the dermal allograft into the repair. So it's just like a standard transosseous equivalent, but my graft is incorporated into the repair.
That's nice. Nice job.
Any other comments, Steve or Sharif?
No, it looks beautiful, Rob. It looks fairly efficient.
Yeah, it took a lot of editing, let's just say. It doesn't always go this smooth, but it's doable. It's doable. All right, well, guys, Gus, Steve, and Sharif, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and your expertise. This was very fun. I look forward to seeing all of you in Miami for Shoulder 360 and invite all of our listeners to join as well. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
I think we should also thank the Ortho Bullets because I really think this coin flips kind of series that they have for all different things. I know Derek Moore is really passionate about trying to teach people that there's variability in what we do. And this kind of tries to really bring it to life. And I think that's really an important point for the learners out there, that there are a lot of ways to do certain things. And all of those ways usually have a pretty good outcome or have good reasons. So there's not one way to approach any of this stuff.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys. Good job, Rafi.
Good job, Rafi.